From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Move over Jeff Bezos, Larry Page, and Sergey Brin. Amazon, Google, eBay make room at the table. Here comes China's Jack Ma and China's e-commerce internet giant Alibaba. Jack Ma is, or is about to be, the richest man in China. He's here in the U.S. for Alibaba's road show, wooing and charming investors ahead of what may be the biggest IPO in history. It's a marker of China's growing weight in the online world. This hour on Point, Alibaba makes its big splash in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you just waking up to the big new kid on the block, Jack Ma and his Alibaba? What's it mean for Amazon, Google, the USA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at Apple's launch of the iPhone 6 and the Apple Watch. But first, Alibaba's American Roadshow. Here was China's CCTV yesterday reporting on Jack Ma's American Roadshow and the upcoming Alibaba IPO.
中国电商企业阿里巴巴今天在美国和亚洲同时启动上市路演。据推算，阿里巴巴。
And here's Jack Ma himself in a promotional video launched yesterday online at Youku.com. Jack Ma retelling his company's creation story.
Hello, I'm Jack Ma, founder and chairman of Alibaba Group. 15 years ago, 18 founders in my apartment had a dream that someday we can build up a company that can serve millions of small businesses.
And what's he ready for now? Right here.
Today, 15 years past, we grow so significantly and has become a household name in China. And soon, we're ready for the world to know us.
Ready for the world to know us, and they will. Next week, IPO. Joining me now from New York is Telus Demos, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. He's been covering Alibaba's big move into U.S. capital markets and was at the company's IPO roadshow at the Waldorf Astoria in New York on Monday. Telus, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What's the big message from Alibaba to potential investors?
The big message is that they are ready to be one of the biggest public companies in the world. They've got the management team. They've got the breadth of businesses. They've got the scale of opportunity to be considered, you know, one of the premier kind of public companies in the world.
What does Alibaba do?
So Alibaba is, as everyone says, an e-commerce company. What does that mean exactly? They are a little bit like a bunch of companies in the U.S. They've got elements of Amazon, elements of eBay. The closest thing, though, would be eBay in the sense that Alibaba, unlike Amazon, doesn't actually have warehouses where it has goods and sells them to you. Alibaba is a connector. It's a marketplace. It sets up a website. It has infrastructure that allows hundreds of thousands, if not millions of small businesses in around China to basically find buyers. They come there to the marketplace. Alibaba makes fees either charging, you know, advertising to these companies to allow them to be found in searches. It also takes commissions on some sales. And over the last few years, it's also evolved where it creates basically online stores for some of the biggest brands in the world, Apple, Nike, for companies like that to sell into China. So they basically stand as the middleman across, you know, billions of transactions every day in China.
So it's business-to-business sales. It's business-to-consumer. It's consumer-to-consumer.
That's right. It's all the above. Alibaba got its start. It was probably best known in the early days for its kind of global wholesale business. That is, it allowed suppliers in China to go on Alibaba.com, which is the website that, you know, kind of most Americans might be familiar with, to sell, you know, basically large numbers of goods at, you know, very cheap prices to pretty much anyone out in the world. So, you know, big businesses got used to going to China to source parts cheaply. You know, they could find things that could be manufactured at a fraction of the cost that they could here in the U.S. And today, pretty much anybody can go on Alibaba.com and order, you know, either, you know, 100,000 motors or, you know, a million screws or something like that from a Chinese supplier. So that was their kind of initial business, which
was a pretty big deal in itself. I mean, to turning all that Chinese productivity out to the world, it's on our shelves and in all of the equipment in this country now.
Absolutely. It meant that you didn't have to go to China to know somebody or speak Chinese in order to access that. Really, anybody could take advantage of what was going on over there and the manufacturing kind of revolution that was changing that economy and also ours here.
How does the scale of Alibaba compare to the scale of America's internet giants?
Well, in terms of the number of transactions, it really dwarfs them. Alibaba conducted about $300 billion worth of transactions happened last year through Alibaba's various marketplaces. Amazon, by contrast, about $100 billion worth of transactions happened there last year. So in some respects, you know, Alibaba is bigger than pretty much any of the kind of e-commerce sites that you know here in the U.S., bigger than all of them combined. However, because Alibaba doesn't actually sell anything itself, it doesn't touch the goods, it's not quite as big as some of those companies in terms of revenues. Last year, Alibaba had about $8 billion in revenues. Amazon, by contrast, had about $80 billion. So it's a very different kind of business. It's also, as a result of not actually having to touch any goods and build warehouses, it's much more profitable.
Why is Alibaba coming to the United States, to Wall Street, to raise capital? There's a lot of money in China.
There's tons of money in China, and if Alibaba had had its druthers, it probably would be listed in China. But there are a couple of things that prevented them from that from happening. The first is that Alibaba is not actually a Chinese company in many respects. It's technically a company incorporated in the Cayman Islands. China has rules about foreign companies listing inside of China, in mainland China, and the Shanghai market. So therefore, Alibaba couldn't list there. It negotiated to go public in Hong Kong, which is the closest market and where a lot of Chinese investors do have access to that market. But Hong Kong has rules about governance, about the way that companies are managed. And Alibaba didn't meet those rules because they have a group of partners who effectively control the board of directors. So in that respect, the U.S. was sort of the default option. Now, of course, it's not a bad option. And in some respects, maybe some people think that they should have just gone there in the beginning because the U.S. has the biggest, deepest market. And that's where investors around the globe really go, especially for internet companies. Investors here really understand and know internet companies. They understand the e-commerce business. So it's not as if Alibaba necessarily lost anything. But I think, you know, that Jack Ma's ambition would have been to have a China-listed company in some respects.
We'll talk about this, but if Alibaba's corporate structure was not ship-shape and tidy enough for Hong Kong, why is it good enough for Wall Street?
Well, Wall Street is the U.S. has a very different attitude about these things. It is, perhaps unsurprisingly, more of a laissez-faire regime in which as long as you disclose what's going on with your company, it's probably okay. And it also has exceptions for foreign companies. There was some concern, you know, about 10, 15 years ago that the U.S. was over-regulating itself and would close itself off to foreign companies who didn't want to come here and meet some of our kind of higher regulatory costs. So they created exceptions for foreign companies. Alibaba so doesn't even really need to meet some of the U.S. standards for governance or the standards to list on U.S. exchanges. But in general, I think the attitude of a lot of U.S. investors is, well, if I know it, I can price it. I can adjust maybe what I might pay for that stock, but at least I know what's going on over there. It's a very different attitude from Hong Kong, which feels like it needs to protect investors from companies that may have governance structures that don't benefit them.
Duly noted. We'll look more closely at that. Comes out next week. They're saying $60 plus per share is what they're likely to offer at. If another potential tranche of shares come into the market, I'm reading here, this could be the biggest initial public offering anywhere in the world in history. Could topple the number one at the moment, Agricultural Bank of China, which was $22 billion back in 2010.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing given the fact that, you know, this is a company that was founded in 1999 and, you know, could have a bigger debut than a lot of U.S. giants, than when Visa went public, when GM went public, when Kraft went public. This would dwarf any of those. And it reflects the fact that, you know, investors are willing to pay an enormous premium to have access to the Chinese market. And it also reflects the fact that, you know, some big companies invested in Alibaba very early on. Yahoo, for example, was the kind of largest early investor in Alibaba, and now it's beginning to cash out some of that stake. So that's in part why this offering is so big, is because Yahoo, by sort of agreement with Alibaba, is beginning to sell down some of that ownership.
Telos Demos with The Wall Street Journal standby in New York. Joel Backler joins us now from Washington, Associate VP at Frontier Strategy Group. Joel Backler, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What matters about Alibaba?
First and foremost, what we need to think about is what matters in terms of what does Alibaba's IPO mean for its international aspirations? So one of the things that I wrote about earlier this week in Forbes is that, first and foremost, Alibaba is going to be looking to focus and continue to focus on the Chinese market. As Talise just mentioned, it has a dominant share of its market across the C2C sector, the B2C sector. Its Taobao marketplace has over 90% of the market. Tmall has over 50% of the market. And the more interesting interesting thing is there's a lot of room for it to grow in terms of just the level of online shoppers that are still going online in China every single day. But one of the things that we need to be looking out for in the medium to long term is the fact that Alibaba is going to have to go global. They're going to have to look outside of China and continue to look for new areas of growth. What we're seeing here right now is the reason why it won't be an immediate priority is you're already seeing companies like Baidu, VIP Shop, Youku Tudou. All of these firms have already listed in the U.S., and they all continue to be focused first and foremost on the Chinese market, and only Baidu really is starting to look a little bit outside of the Chinese market.
But I'm looking here at a Bloomberg headline says, global battle with Amazon looms. Will this be a tough competitor for American internet companies, Joel?
I don't think so. I think in the short term, you'll see it continue to make moves. We've seen some acquisitions that it's made. It's opened up a marketplace called 11 Main that's targeted for small business to consumers in the United States. It has AliExpress, which allows buyers to get smaller size quantities of goods here in the U.S. But overall, the majority of its operations are and will continue to be in China. It's already facing more and more competition. Just last month, Wanda, Baidu, and Tencent, three very large companies, they actually opened up a separate company to go against Alibaba in China. And we're going to continue to see this increase and its focus continue to decrease.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's internet giant, Alibaba, going global, going public next week on Wall Street, looking at what that means for global internet dominance. Asking, is China's giant here, Alibaba, poised to take over e-commerce and maybe more? It is dominant in China. That is a big position in the world. Telus Dimos is with us from the Wall Street Journal this hour in New York. Joel Backler with us from the Frontier Strategy Group in Washington, author of China Goes West. Here's a little bit more of Jack Ma in a promotional video released yesterday, part of Alibaba's roadshow to crank up enthusiasm for its stock offering next week in New York. Here's Jack Ma.
At Alibaba, we fight for the little guy, the small businessman and woman, and their customers. Our role is simple. Through our ecosystem, we help merchants and customers find each other and conduct business on their terms and in ways that best serve their unique needs.
All over the world. Tell us, Joel, stand by. Heather Timmons joins us right now from Hong Kong, Asia correspondent for the online business journal Quartz. Heather Timmons, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What is Jack Ma's reputation, his presence in China, Chinese culture, business culture, Heather?
Oh, he's the god of entrepreneurism. You know, he's such a he's got this background as an English teacher, and he started this company out of his apartment with a bunch of his friends. And there are books devoted to sort of how you can sell things on Alibaba, but also dozens of biographies about him and how you can sort of become an entrepreneur just like Jack Ma. So he's the person that anybody who's got a startup business really wants to be.
He talks a lot about culture and life beyond business, talks about transforming the world, China. What's his vision?
Well, I think he is not kidding when he says he wants to transform commerce and global commerce. And right now the company is very focused on China and is doing about 85% of its sales there. But they've been going great with their AliExpress, especially in Russia. It's now the largest online shopping platform in Russia, for example. And people in Russia are actually ordering goods through Alibaba and waiting longer to have them shipped directly from China rather than going to their corner store. So if you can just sort of imagine that spreading out across the globe, I think that's what we're talking about.
A lot of Americans have made a lot of money being middlemen for a tsunami of Chinese products that have come into this country over the last, 15, 20 years. Could Alibaba cut out the middlemen and just set up, direct? Here we go. China sells right to consumers, end-game businesses in the U.S.
Well, ultimately, in the long run, sure, why not? And that's a really interesting question because a lot of the U.S. wholesalers and distributors are actually small mom-and-pop companies. Those are not, that's not a business that's dominated by one or two big players. So I could see that it would be pretty easy, actually, for them to come in and take them out.
And what about Amazon with its warehouse and retailing model? Will Alibaba, do you think, ultimately be a competitor for Amazon?
It's hard to say. It's hard to find a place where they really go head to head. You know, we looked around for that, and it turns out that in Malaysia, they're both trying to sell to consumers, and it's sort of neck and neck right now. The good thing about Amazon, I guess, is that you can return it quickly and easily, which is going to be hard to do if your goods are coming from China.
Tell us, Demos, we took the show On Point to Shanghai a couple of years back, and a big official in the Communist Party said to us there, look, sooner or later, there are going to be more Chinese online than anybody else in the world, and more Chinese activity, including business activity online. We will dominate the internet. Is Alibaba's global coming out party part of that? Tell us. We're so accustomed to American business and American mores dominating the way the web works and the way business on the web goes. Is Alibaba's ascent a signal that that may be changing?
Well, I think that what we're learning is that that business models and innovation and, you know, people coming up with ways to make money out of selling and displaying things on the internet have really progressed a lot further in some respects in China and other countries in Asia than they have here in the U.S. And I think what Alibaba shows is that the way that we're used to doing business here, this kind of merchant model, this kind of retail model where, you know, one firm is sort of the hub and they kind of bring all the inventory in and sell it to people, is not necessarily the only way to really go about doing things. And so I think that what U.S. investors and U.S. entrepreneurs are learning is that, to find innovation, they may need to look to China where, you know, they combine internet businesses in all kinds of ways that we don't here in the U.S. For example, you know, gaming is often combined with commerce, right? Like there's a way that, you know, if you've got a great game, the difficulty is monetizing it. How do you get people to pay for it? Well, if you tie it to chat or if you tie it to buying things online, you know, you can kind of come up with a business model that really works. So I think that really this is the beginning of the sort of internationalization, not only of the businesses themselves, but also of thinking about how to structure these businesses and ways to make money from, you know, kind of new online markets.
We made the mold for the internet in the United States, now China and others, but Alibaba, not least, and Jack Ma shaking it up. Heather Timmons, e-commerce has been so big in China in part because their brick-and-mortar retailing world was so underdeveloped that people are going straight to e-commerce as their mainstay for buying and selling, Heather.
Absolutely. And it's just an easier way to buy anything. People buy household goods, you know, stuff you would go to the grocery store. People buy, I heard a story about someone who sourced their entire wedding from Alibaba shopping, except for maybe her bridal dress. Yeah. So it's faster, it's easier. The distribution network in the form of the post office, you know, the state-run post office isn't very good. So you can instead go online, order it from one of these companies, have an independent distributor send it to you, or an independent shipper send it to you, and get it faster and cheaper.
Hello world, Alibaba calling. Here's Jack Ma. This was last year, a speech he gave at the Credit Suisse Asian Investment Congress conference, saying that in China, e-commerce is the main course. In the U.S., it's just dessert.
The difference between China e-commerce and the U.S. e-commerce is that the e-commerce in the USA is, which I call it, is a dessert. It's just a supplementary to their main business because the USA infrastructure of doing business is so good. So it is very difficult for e-commerce in the USA to grow, to develop, to surpass the traditional business. But in China, because of the infrastructure of commerce is too bad, and e-commerce become the main course.
The main course, and now Alibaba coming here to raise capital. Joel Backler, it looks like people are lining up to buy these shares in the U.S. on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of interest. I mean, there's obviously a number of questions about the pricing levels and really what we'll see kind of after that IPO. I think, though, Jack Ma really hit it on the dot, which is the fact that here in the U.S. for e-commerce, it's really an afterthought, whereas in China, it's so critical to get goods into these second and third tier cities. I mean, the market itself is so large. And as a result, you know, Alibaba's success has really been designed in order to capitalize on the fact that it can get goods to very remote places and fill a gap that no one else really can. And you see that really, I think, due to the leadership and Alibaba and Jack Ma getting that exposure internationally early on, so he understands how these models have worked well in the U.S. and then adapting them for kind of the unique nuances of the Chinese market. And I think that's going to continue to make the business be very strong in the short term as we see it to continue to have strong growth in China.
As of next week, they'll have that giant market in China and a giant bankroll, if everything goes to plan, raised on Wall Street in New York City. Let's go to our listeners, Plum Lake, Wisconsin. Allison is calling. Hi, Allison. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think this company and investing in this company is a gigantic mistake. I think they're very naive to think with a country like in China where they don't honor our copyright and they're spying on our government, they don't have bricks and mortar locations, so we're interested in knocking out all the American business people who are currently middlemen, if you want to put that in quotes, for products around the world. We'll knock them out and send all of our business, all about cheap, offshore to Chinese businesses. I mean, the Chinese have had billions of dollars for thousands of years. We're a very new economy. For us to think we're the ones that have a lot of freedom and of innovation, but we also have a moral structure to this country, which they won't honor.
Well, of course, China was dirt poor not long ago, but it's definitely not now. Tell us, what about Americans looking at this? You hear Allison's concerns, and we have seen American manufacturing just go, boom, off to China. All kinds of concerns about the security of data online. Of course, we've got our own homegrown concerns on that front, but China's been very much in the headlines. Corporate governance, famously or infamously, not transparent in China, and yet here it comes right into the heart of Wall Street. Should Americans be concerned about this, or does this create opportunity, tell us?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, one of the major questions that investors have about Alibaba and also, you know, from just business people is you know, and this was raised, the issue of copyright protection. You know, it's in some respects a lot easier for, you know, kind of a small business in China to, you know, go on this marketplace and pass off, you know, counterfeit goods or to bypass copyright protections. Alibaba has faced, you know, problems with kind of U.S. authorities in the past where they've branded them kind of a hub of piracy. Alibaba has obviously tried to work very hard to, you know, police its markets. They say that they've made a lot of progress on, you know, making sure to that you know, goods on their site aren't counterfeit. But, you know, like we've talked about, when you've got a gigantic $300 billion marketplace, I'm sure it's very difficult to excise all of that. So that's certainly a question I think that you know, businesses here will have as they begin to compete more and more with, you know, Chinese companies, you know, selling into other markets online is, you know, are they necessarily following the same rules that we are? And, you know, but then as far as, you know, kind of the question of whether U.S. businesses are at a loss, you know, are competing unfairly with Chinese businesses, you know, it all depends, right? If you're somebody who's trying to build something, if you can find parts more cheaply in China, then you might see that as an advantage. And as somebody raised before, you know, the idea of, you know, Chinese companies sort of selling directly to U.S. companies and putting the middlemen out of business, I'm not sure if that's something that will happen immediately. As somebody said, you know, it's difficult to get things returned. You know, one of the advantages that, you know, an Amazon model has is, you know, Amazon can deliver something to you virtually instantly. You know, we're talking about drones and things like that. When you're just a marketplace model, when you're not touching every good sold, you can't necessarily assure that same level of quality. And in fact, Alibaba itself faces competition in China along those lines. You know, there was a recent IPO of a company called JD.com, which is more of an Amazon-type company. You know, they have armies of delivery people on scooters who will make sure that you get your goods on time, that they come unbroken and undamaged and things like that. So, you know, I don't think we should necessarily take for granted that everybody wants or that the only business model that will win out is this kind of free-for-all model.
Wayne in Austin, Texas. Wayne, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom. I'm echoing Allison's concern about kind of the moral fundament or trustability of a major Chinese outfit. For example, if a similar Russian outfit, I would be truly distrustful, that's say. But a second question along those lines is that it seems that we've twisted the rules or relaxed the rules for foreign companies. Isn't it a fair challenge from American companies that, hey, it's an unlevel playing field? Likewise, going the other direction, Amazon's abilities to open up in China have not been as open as it seems to Alibaba's opportunities in the American market. Isn't there a fundamental unfairness here?
An equity issue there. Wayne, thanks for your call from Austin. Heather Timmons, what about it? American players in China start with Amazon. Do they have a clear field, as clear as Alibaba's here?
No, absolutely not. No, they definitely don't. And I don't think... I don't think any of those companies think that this is sort of a level playing field at all. Just to address the sort of quality of goods issue, Alibaba has had a huge problem with fraud that it is trying to control. They did create something to reassure their own Chinese buyers, which is sort of an escrow system where you as the buyer put money into an escrow account and the seller doesn't actually get it until you've received your goods. So that's the way that they're trying to allay some of those fears, at least in China. I guess to play devil's advocate here,
yes,
I would say there's so much of our goods in the U.S. that we're already getting from China. You know, by bringing this company in and maybe making it easier eventually down the road for you to get your goods directly from a manufacturer, what is the huge harm in that?
Could it work two ways, Joel? Could Alibaba be a marketplace for Americans to sell into China with equal ease?
Yes, I mean, I think we're going to continue to see the rise of cross-border e-commerce between China and the U.S., but I think more importantly, back to Allison's question, is that, you know, a Chinese company coming to the U.S. to operate, they can't play by a separate set of rules. They're bound by the same regulations as any company doing business here, and quite frankly, nothing's really changed. I mean, we've seen China as the world's exporter, and today we're talking about Alibaba as the world's consumer, but as China invests in the U.S., you're actually going to see positive improvements to the manufacturing and production output here. I mean, just last year, we had about 70,000 jobs added by Chinese firms here in the U.S. Many of these were in the manufacturing sector and in areas that previously were facing tough times due to that initial push to outsourcing. You know, the environment in China has changed dramatically. Wages have increased. The cost of doing business is getting tougher. And the whole idea of China as the world's factory right now doesn't necessarily ring true the same way it did, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Tell us, and yet it rings a little sour that at this moment of Alibaba glory, we hear Heather just say flatly, no, American companies cannot have the same free reign in China that Alibaba has here.
The issue is even more complex for Alibaba itself. You know, trying to be an international company listed in the U.S., incorporated outside of China, they've faced restrictions on things that they can do in China, which has actually led to them having to make some controversial moves in order to set up their company. So I think people see. And in fact, some investors actually like this fact about them, that they have this kind of global playing field in front of them. But, you know, can you look at a U.S. player and say, okay, when are they going to get into China? So that inequality of opportunity, in fact, is a reason that some people actually want to buy the stock.
Joel, that pushing up the stock price next week, I mean, great for investors, but maybe not so great for others.
Yeah, I mean, I, again, going back to that, I think if you look at Amazon and just the internet in general in China, you see that it tends to be more regulated, but you also see that there are pockets of opportunity that are emerging for American firms. I mean, Amazon, they entered the special economic zone in China fairly recently, but with internet companies, I think, being regulated highly more than any other industry in China, unless it's related to e-commerce, companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter would all have similar issues. So I think it's important as we look at Chinese companies entering the U.S. like Alibaba, we need to recognize that they're coming here to invest in IPO, but also they're going to be looking to make substantial investments in the local communities over time.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about China's internet giant Alibaba going global, going public next week on Wall Street. You can join us. Does Alibaba's rise mean China's ways, rules, will come to rule the internet? With Joel Backler at the Frontier Strategy Group in Washington, Telus Dimos with the Wall Street Journal joins us from New York, Heather Timmons with Quartz joins us from Hong Kong, Deborah in Austin, Texas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Deborah.
Hi, Tom. I actually used Alibaba once. That was all it took.
Why?
Well, first off, what they sent me was counterfeit. There's a huge counterfeit business in cosmetics coming out of there. Secondly, when you return it, you might as well write your money off because you're never going to see it.
So do you think it's got self-limiting opportunities in this country that it can't make it because you didn't like your interaction?
Well, I kind of believe that once the American public experiences what my experience was as a small business owner, they won't reorder.
Deborah, we've got it. Counterfeit cosmetics from China doesn't sound like something I'd like to put a lot of on my face. But we'll see. I appreciate your call. John in Boston. You're on, John.
Hello.
Hi. What's your experience?
Well, I work for a small electronics design and manufacturing company, and my experience with Alibaba has been terrific. They make a wide range of vendors available very quickly, very responsive. I have had many more bad experiences dealing with U.S. companies, and frankly, I don't see why I should be supporting a U.S. distributor when I can get the same parts for a lot less money direct from the manufacturer and be able to resell them as part of my product and have my product cost less as a result.
So, John, it sounds like you're delighted to engage products at a fraction of the price and direct from the maker in China.
Yes, I can't say there's no risk, but the same goes for any business.
Would you use Alibaba to sell your end product back to China? Have you? Have you tried? Thought about it?
I have not, actually, but it wouldn't be a bad idea if I came up with something that I thought would be a big hit.
So there's a no thanks in Austin, a yes please in Boston. One more here, Montgomery, Alabama. Nikki, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, This IPO has the potential to put a tremendous or an unprecedented amount of money in the Chinese people's hands. The power base in China has not been particularly malleable into history at this point. What guarantee do we as American investors have that the Chinese government won't step in and seize or publicize this company or nationalize this company?
Nationalize. I guess they've got all kinds of interests here. Of course, there's a lot of cash already in Chinese hands at this point. But Heather Timmons, what about it? What about the Chinese government role? They have an ownership stake, I believe, in Alibaba. What is it? What's their influence here?
Right now, the Chinese government doesn't have an outright ownership stake in Alibaba, though there are investment companies run by the Chinese government that have stakes in some of its units.
Yeah.
The company has listed in its prospectus very clearly that the Chinese government is one of sort of the risks that investors should be aware of, and that rules change sometimes, and it may in fact not be aware that it's doing something wrong when it's doing it. And the Chinese government does control the sort of the pipes that make the internet work. You know, they control the telecom companies, and there is no alternative. So those are absolutely risks. I think if the Chinese government were to outright take over Alibaba and in some way ruin its online shopping platform, which it would almost certainly do, there'd be some sort of revolt. There's so many millions of people using this right now, small business people selling their goods, other small business people buying parts and things, that it would just, I think it would be politically impossible for them to do.
Tell us, Demos, but does the United States, does the world at some level import Chinese standards, Chinese ways, along with Alibaba? I mean, the very structure of the company, it's called this variable interest entity, VIE, that's required by the Chinese government for foreign ownership in certain industries. We had a U.S. congressional commission that looked at this kind of ownership and said shareholders face major risks investing in companies using a VIE. And yet here it is, going public on Wall Street, maybe the biggest ever next week. Tell us, do we import Chinese business practices? Does China ultimately come to dominate internet structure and business practices through this kind of expansion?
Well, I think there's two separate things going on here. One is that we are with this VIE structure being the way that a lot of Chinese companies that are listed here in the U.S. have some of their businesses set up. We're kind of importing not necessarily Chinese business practices, but China risk into the U.S. market. You know, Alibaba will be like we've talked about, one of the biggest listed companies here in the U.S. If something were to happen to its structure, if Beijing were to decide that it didn't like the way that it was set up, that would obviously introduce, you know, kind of a new type of risk into a widely held U.S. company. The other question is, of course, are we importing the business practices of Alibaba? And I guess on that point, you know, the way that Alibaba has set itself up is there's a partnership. There are 30 people, Jack Ma is obviously one of them, who will retain, even after the company goes public, potentially for as long as this is a public company, will retain an ability to sort of nominate the members of the board. Outside shareholders will still be able to vote on those people, but this partnership, which the company says and Jack Ma has said is essential to maintaining the kind of entrepreneurial culture that built Alibaba in the first place, they will have a big influence on the company.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Jack Ma says he wants this company to last for 100 years, and that's the reason he's got this structure. But it means less transparency, less shareholder sway. Good thing or bad thing? Tell us.
Well, I think, it's not entirely foreign in the U.S. There are a lot of companies that actually have a what's called a dual class share structure in which, for example, Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg owns a separate class of shares that even though he doesn't own a majority of the company, it gives him basically, a majority vote in what happens, in big corporate decisions. The same thing was true of Google. Many kind of U.S. tech companies, especially those with kind of well-known, charismatic, visionary founders, have used this structure. And so far, it hasn't really kept them back as a stock. Facebook stock has done very well. Google's has done extraordinarily well since going public. So in some respects, U.S. investors like, giving a lot of power to these founders and say, look, we don't want this company to be thinking short term. We want them to be thinking for the next 100 years. So let's give them the power to do so. But these are companies that have been enjoying mostly good times. We've seen a lot of companies, the rise of shareholder activism in the U.S. has in some ways been a response to companies that are too tightly controlled by a CEO or by a founder and that they don't think are going very well. If Alibaba were to start to struggle in the future, people might suddenly, people who are now looking at this partnership structure and saying, I don't mind or I like it, they might start to say, wait a second, these guys aren't even doing a great job with this company. Why are we sort of handing over power to them? So it could be something that could be a drag on the company in the future. But, do I think whether or not we're going to see this structure more commonly in the United States, whether this sort of the idea of the kind of the close-knit sort of family that I think has some resonance in Chinese culture, whether we're going to see that more in the U.S., maybe it depends on the success of Alibaba. If we see that these sort of entrepreneurial cliques are good at running companies and building them for the long term, it might be something that more U.S. companies begin to adopt. But again, it's a practice that isn't totally unfamiliar here already.
Heather Timmons, we've just got half a minute before we look at Apple. From your seat in Hong Kong, where does Alibaba's ascent tell you the web is evolving, the direction of the internet?
Obviously, sort of China owns internet commerce, at least from this corner of the world. And Hong Kong, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange is very sorry it didn't get the IPO.
Yeah. Lots of billions will be rolling on Wall Street next week when this comes on down the pike. Pricing, we're told, on Thursday, hit the market on Friday. Thanks to all three of you for helping us look at Alibaba's coming out in the USA. Heather Timmons with Quartz in Hong Kong, Asia correspondent there. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Joel Backler at Frontier Strategy Group in Washington, D.C. Mr. Backler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Telus Demos at the Wall Street Journal in New York. We will be watching your reporting, Telus. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, Apple's new product launch. This is On Point. Apple CEO Tim Cook took to the stage in Cupertino yesterday to announce the release of Apple's new, bigger iPhone.
Today, we are launching the biggest advancement in the history of iPhone.
And by biggest, I guess he simply means the size of the screen there, because it is, and phones are going this way, bigger. And the launch was about more than a bigger screen. With the iPhone 6 comes the Apple Watch and Apple Pay. Apple looking to shake things up again. Joining me now from New York is John Simons, technology and media editor for the Associated Press. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the biggest piece of the announcement yesterday? A bigger screen on some of these iPhone 6s? Or is it the Apple Watch? Is it Apple Pay? Parse them out.
I think it's Apple Pay. And this is a technology that Apple has infused into these new, bigger phones that will allow people to go into brick-and-mortar stores and make purchases by simply swiping their phone along the point-of-sale machinery at the checkout counter.
How many people are doing that now, or will it be brand new when these hit the market?
This is not a new technology. A lot of people have been waiting for Apple to introduce this into their phones. This is a capability that a lot of other phones have had, a lot of other Android phones that are made by Samsung and HTC, and where the software that runs the phone is provided by, of course, Google, which makes Android.
People are pretty freaked out about credit card security and lack thereof, Target and Home Depot and all the rest. Will Apple Pay make it more secure? Would that be a draw for people to use this?
Apple will say that the system is more secure than using your credit card, and that's simply because the person at the checkout counter doesn't actually see your card number. So they don't know anything about, you know, about your card's information. But the same sorts of, you know, concerns that apply to using your credit card at a major retailer these days apply to using this technology, because of course some of the information is stored on remote servers somewhere that, you know, hackers can get into.
So is Apple making projections of how much of credit card use may go to this kind of electronic tap my phone, wave my phone, Apple Pay arena? How soon?
Yeah, if you listen to Apple, they'll say that this technology is a credit card killer. And you know what's interesting here is that when you look at consumers and you ask them in polls, are you concerned about your privacy? Are you concerned about hackers? Are you concerned about NSA surveillance? People will say that Americans will say that they're very concerned about this stuff, but that concern is not reflected in their actions. People continue to use all sorts of new technologies in the name of convenience, and it seems like, you know, convenience is trumping all these privacy and security concerns.
So does that mean Apple's moving to become kind of a bank, or does it still have to win and on technology, on gear and gizmos, phones, and now the watch?
That's a really good question. Apple still makes the majority of its profits selling hardware. So they have deals with MasterCard and Visa and that sort of thing to help kind of facilitate these purchases and these transactions. But Apple's not becoming a bank. They're still interested in selling gadgets.
Lots of buzz about the watch, the Apple Watch. What's the market for that? I mean, the iPhones or phones are so much bigger. Smartphones are so much bigger now. Does Apple really think everyone's going to adopt this? You've got to have an iPhone to use this. So you have a smartphone in your pocket and a computer on your wrist. Is that their bet?
Right. And, you know, what's the market for that is the question that I think lots of consumers are asking themselves. You know, right now there are lots of different smartphones available on the market. If you walk into a store like Best Buy, you'll see tons of them, and they haven't really sold very well. And I think it's because the companies haven't made a really good use case for them.
You're talking about the Pebble and Sony's wrist computer and Samsung's and the rest.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There are many of them. They do all sorts of things like track the number of steps you take each day. They can help you sort of log your runs if you're a runner. They can check your pulse and your heart rate and things like that. And Apple's Watch can do all those things too. It's just a question of how useful those things are. Are they worth the $350 that this watch is going to cost? And do you really need something that provides a few extra things and then a few things that have limited functionality that are offered on your cell phone in full functionality? And, you know, for people like me and you and many of your listeners, I'm sure their cell phones are within arm's reach anyway. Why do you need something at the end of your wrist?
And John, what about the core competition on the smartphone front? Competitors have made headway with bigger screens. Now Apple's going bigger. How's Apple stand positioned to compete?
Absolutely. That is a question that a lot of the analysts that are looking at Apple are wondering. Apple has traditionally been able to enter markets late, survey the landscape, see what's working and what's not working, and then introduce something that is really sort of forward-looking. And they've been this kind of creative imitator in a lot of different markets. With the iPod, they weren't the first to come out with a digital music player. They weren't the first company to introduce a tablet. They weren't the first company with a smartphone. But the question with a lot of these new developments yesterday, including the bigger phones, is whether they can rely on their history of doing this into the future. Samsung has done very well with larger smartphones, and they are Samsung is the world's number one seller of smartphones. You wouldn't know that if you were sort of walking around major cities in the U.S. where lots of people have iPhones. That's always a surprising fact to a lot of people. But Apple is trying to catch up. They're trying to win back a lot of people who were interested in a larger screen and moved to Android phones made by Samsung and HTC and others.
And now Apple making its play with the iPhone 6. We'll see how it goes. John Simons is technology and media editor for the AP in New York. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.